I'm W.S. Thackeray. I'm interviewing Air Marshal C.R. Dunlap. It's the 14th of October, 1980.
It's October, 1980, yes. And you're... we're lucky to get together this morning, Bill, because perhaps it's the first time you, in your life you've taken precedence over a four-star general, but I should be out at the airport meeting Air Chief Marshal Miller at the moment. But... I managed to delegate my wife to do that. Here we are. I thought maybe it'd be more important to you to get on with this than for me to get out there and meet him.
Thank you.
Well, now, before I go on with that continuation of the tape we left off last month, I think I'll just recap for a moment to pull a few of the factors together which indicate the urgency of what we're trying to do. First of all, the wing was sent out to North Africa to participate in Operation Husky, which was to be the landings in Sicily and then subsequently up in through Italy. The wing had formed in the UK about mid-May. Comprised of three squadrons, 424, 24, and 425. The move out to North Africa was sort of a complex one, in that the ground crew, the supplies, and the equipment had to be loaded aboard ships, had to join a convoy, and had to sail, which they did about the middle of May. Now the air crew, of course, were following on later with their aircraft. They were busy in the interval getting re-equipped with brand new Wellingtons, Wellington Mark 10s, which were all modified for desert operations. And they were to hold in the UK until the right moment to come out and join up with their equipment on a suitable airfield. Yet to be located. All of this had to be accomplished in time to participate in the softening up process before the landings in Sicily. I, of course, myself at that stage didn't know the precise date of the landings in Sicily. That was being held very, guarded very closely, and of course it depended on a number of factors of the moment and a future moment in time, so that no one as early as that actually did know the precise date. Even those that did, of course, held it very closely to the chest. But nonetheless, I knew pretty well the period, and therefore I knew the period that I had to be out there and have those squadrons ready and have them established, ready for operation. it transpired that when I arrived on scene, and I flew out with two of my staff officers, McCann and Boggs, I flew out there towards the end of May, only to discover on meeting with Air Chief Marshal Petter and his staff, that there were no airfields available on the plains of Tunisia because there was such a concentration of air power out there, all the airfields had been used up. Furthermore, the claim was that it was not possible to supply anymore down there. There was a logistics problem. This didn't please me at all. When I found the alternative being that we were going to have to operate from mountain airfields in the valleys of the mountains of Tunisia. Those are fields that had been established for the use of Americans during the final campaign against the German and Italian forces. see on the plains of Tunisia. They were operating out of these mountain airfields because they that was as close as they could get at that time to the scene of action, the scene of activity. The Germans and the Italians occupying all that flat country. It didn't appeal to me at all to operate night bomber forces from airfields in narrow valleys surrounded by mountains. And I was determined that this wouldn't take place. So 2 days after arrival in Algeria, where I had conferred with the staff of Mediterranean Air Force headquarters, I went on my way to Constantine, which was the location headquarters of the North African Strategic Air Force under command of General Doolittle. And my wing was to be a component of his formation. So I went to see Jimmy Doolittle and his chief of staff, General Pat Partridge, and discussed this problem with them. They were most sympathetic and most helpful. And their recommendation was that I should jump into one of their aircraft and fly down to Karawan in Tunisia. And survey the situation and see if there was some solution. Incidentally, Doolittle's headquarters was at Constantine. Constantine is still in Algeria, but it was near the border of Algeria and Tunisia.
Did they feel there was a supply problem as well?
They didn't put as much weight on that.
No, okay.
As the people way back in Algeria. See, Algeria was a long way from the front.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a long way from the area in which I was often still operating, hundreds of miles back. So things looked quite different from way back there. To Doolittle and Partridge and his staff, of course, they already had all sorts of aircraft, all sorts of wings and groups and formations down there on the operating page of Tunisia. They had perhaps a better feel for what was possible and what wasn't possible. So Partridge very kindly loaned me his little communications aircraft, an AT-6, somewhat the equivalent of a Harvard. And I flew down and conferred with Group Captain Powell, the commander of one of the Royal Air Force wings. And in fact, it was a wing that had been sent out from the UK, just as mine was being sent out, to augment the forces that already were out there. There were other Wellington wings that had come across the desert with the Eighth Army, and we were going to join them down there in the plains. Well, Powell proved to be an extremely valuable person to talk to. He was one of these fellows that wasn't prepared to let anything stand in the way of good operating conditions. And he recognized immediately that it would be suicide to try to operate this wing from those airfields. Indeed, he had been threatened. I discovered that he'd been threatened with operating from there, and he had managed to outmaneuver the staff. So he sized the situation up. He said, well, there's no question about it. There are no airfields left that would be suitable for your type of aircraft. If you're going to come down and operate in this part of the world, you're going to have to find suitable ground on which to construct it. Well, the thing that immediately came to mind was that possible of a time factor. Here it was, by now, it was the end of May, early June. The landings were period, the general period of the landings, I had felt would be sometime early in July. And that didn't need very much time. And here I was with all the ground personnel on the high seas and all the air crew and the aircraft still back in the UK waiting for the message to come out and no place to offer. So Powell said, my recommendation is that you plan to be here for the weekly poker game, which is sponsored by the major and his staff, the U.S. Corps of Engineers. They are the people who build airfields, amongst other things. And they have a session to which I'm invited once a week. That doesn't take place for 48 hours from now. You might just go back to Clark Benson down and on that occasion, and I'll set it up for you. And that was the way it came about that I got in touch with the, got into cahoots with the U.S. Corps of Engineers. Meanwhile, of course, I had time went out and, in my little AT-6 and flew at low level all over the plains and found that in some of these rather remote areas, there was flat ground, there was ground that looked to me as though it would be suitable. And for the construction here. And I knew that these fellows had capability of putting the field in operational condition in very, very short space of time. So, to make a long story short, I did have a successful session with the engineers. I did pave the way a bit with a couple of bottles of whiskey, which was a very, very rare commodity out in that part of the world. Two bottles which I had intended to ration very carefully throughout my stay there because there just wasn't anything of that nature available. I'd taken those with me from the UK. I did lose a bit of money at the poker table, more or less purposely, to soften this fellow up. He was a tough nut. He wasn't an easy person to deal with. And so, before the departed there that night, it was agreed that he would come and look over this area that I had spotted from there. And much against his will, he agreed to come in the aircraft with me, and he was fine, but airsick. So we agreed that we'd take off early in the morning before the atmosphere got too turbulent. And we flew over there, and he saw, and then he said, all right, we'll jump in my get him back again to the base. Got into a Jeep and he smarted out there and he surveyed the scene, and that's when we left off the last time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
With the major kicking his heel into the ground to test the soil conditions and to determine whether or not there was enough bearing strength in that soil to support heavily laden from the aircraft. And as you recall, his conclusion was that provided that soil was not broken by the blade of a bulldozer or any such thing as that, as long as the roots of the thistles were allowed to bind the soil together, we would have a surface that was compact and would be firm and hard for our operations. So the way it was left was, and this was about the third 3rd of June. It's not early in June, 3rd or 4th of June. It was left that I would spend the next 30 days, a couple of days anyway, laying out the runway, laying out the boundary point of the runway, marking them with empty gasoline drums, so that people could clearly see where the bounds would be. I decided that we'd have two parallel runways in the prevailing wind and two cross runways. Surrounded by a big taxi track and dispersal points, all the aircraft had to be dispersed because of it. Still a possibility of enemy attack. And we had to have a road system everything had disappeared because that plane, as I mentioned before, was completely covered with these crystals that grew inside the man's head. And they were tinder dry. All I had to do was knock them off. So when we had this lined up, I let him know, and he was on the job about the following day. And he moved in his rubber-tired roller. That was the way he was going to compact his surface. And he had a little truck. I don't know what that's the right word to use, but a little vehicle that had a lot of small tires on them. And tankage on the top of the truck, so he could put in water to use it as weight. And he towed these behind, he had several of these little trucks that went behind, towable behind Jeeps. You put two or three Jeeps on the job. And they just ran those things back and forth, up and down the runway to it for a little over a mile, probably a mile and a half long. And that was sufficient to knock all of the fences, but yet it didn't destroy the root structure.
It was really flat enough, was it? It didn't have to do any grading at all?
No grading at all. And 48 hours later, he had finished that job. And not only at this main airfield, but I had to also lay out a satellite airfield, because it wasn't certain at that point whether I would be able to operate all three squadrons in one field or not. We were still required to respect the dispersal requirements. Although the possibility, likelihood of enemy attack was dwindling, there was still a possibility that we would come under fire, and therefore that meant that the possibility I would only be permitted to have two squadrons in one field and have to use the second field of the squadron. Well, it transpired that one of those nights I was down there involved in that poker operation. One of the nights I stayed with Gustav Powell on his airfield in that town. He did come under enemy attack. And that, of course, led the authorities to believe that it would be unwise for us to concentrate too much force on the field. And therefore, we were compelled to go ahead with getting there. I mean, well, let me see. That was about the 7th or 8th of June, sometime ago. And it was just about that time that the three squadrons arrived from the UK. They really got out there a little bit ahead of time because we done with it, and so we still haven't got any equipment down there. And until they got the supplies and equipment for maintaining the aircraft and the tents for housing personnel, there wasn't any point in the aircraft appearing on scene. So temporarily, they cleaned the Constantine, and actually they were based at Palermo, which is the airfield. So they, at this stage then, I had the ground crew still back here to Algiers when it in fact tells about Algiers on the 6th. They were daughtered in a winery, and the girl too out there. The headquarters personnel, my aircraft were holding in Palermo, and which was then a matter of getting them all assembled and down in one place. So at this point, I took off once more to back to Algiers and got things organized for the move. And it meant that our equipment had all been offloaded now. It meant getting that equipment loaded aboard the train, getting the vehicles, the trucks and the specialized vehicles that we use to get to the airfield operation, on the road and the convoy, get them about 500 miles down through some pretty rugged mountain roads. Getting them underway and getting the whole thing coordinated to get down there at the more or less the same time. Well, everything worked out surprisingly well. The convoys, the motor convoys, got through first, and they brought with them as much of the tankage as they could. So that a fair amount of the tentage came and we were able to get this set up before the bus arrived by rail. Recently it came by rail, arrived around the down here someplace. And bought it right now. Yeah. First convoy arrived out there on the 12th of June. And the second convoy, rather than the two convoys, none of the convoys were about something between 30 and 50 years of speed. And the second one arrived out there on the 15th of June. And they carried with them some personnel, but the bulk of the personnel were to come by train, and that meant going through some of the rail that went along the coast pretty well. I think actually I should have seen some of them on the coast as soon as we were able to meet them as soon as with our lorries and our trucks and things. And they asked me, the first of that group, left Bucharest in Algiers on the 15th, and they got down to the plains where we were on the 17th. It was about a 40-hour drive. It wasn't very comfortable, I mean, but I don't really have seen any of those trains out there, but if you talk to Canada, that the the same kind of immigrants back to this country. Yeah, they found their sense of rugged and rough. You should see the ones out there. What they were traveling were, they were traveling in freight cars and vans. And you could send it, you know, on the side of the van, and jump there, and they could run. Front home. Who, eat, 30 men or 8 horses. So they had a special running day down. I think they're riding sad people. They got on noise and played by the same thing. Well, there you were. There you are. We had, personnel and pennies and equipment arriving on site. And between the, around the 19th of June. And we brought the aircraft down. There was, of course, a period of intense activity when the camp was set up. There were 2,000 men to house and there were the specialized workshops to store these against damage and generators plants to set up and intelligence and operational tech to get into operation and get all of the materials ready for active operations. But I think it's rather amazing how quickly that all fell into place. And we were able, we set up 420 and 425 squadron in the main, squadrons in the main airfield at the field we called Gina. There was a little 2x4 railroad and out in that direction, and there was a tiny little building that acted as a railway depot, and it had the name Gina on it. There wasn't any sign of any community, but we took our name from it. It was Gina. And the next stop on that line, not too far removed from the satellite airfield, and it had the name Cabrillo on it. It's called Cabrillo, but it looked like a Cabrillo. And so we had two fields up there called Gina, named Cabrillo, the satellite auxiliary, and 424 squadron actually set up on it. We had given priority to establishing the main field, and therefore the squadrons on that field were ready for operations to bring ahead of the squadron on the satellite. We were able to declare ourselves ready for operations at Carawan Gina. We took the name Carawan as a label because it was the only place of any consequence out there that people, mainly that people knew. So we described ourselves as Carawan Bracket Gina and Carawan Bracket Cabrillo, even though we were about 40 miles.
Just a moment to interrupt. It must have been a terrific fire hazard there at this time.
Well, there was.
How did you cope with that?
There was. that was a matter that caused a great concern. And I decided that we had to do something about that. And for example, I mentioned the equipment, the taxi track that surrounded the whole airfield complex. And the dispersal points were off adjacent to the taxi track. And the dispersal point was just a great big circle. It was run around there by the beach. And it meant that the tail of the aircraft was standing and running into the aircraft, in a standing dispersal, but not too far removed from these dried up pistols. And I said to the captain, we since we got to there, provide ourselves more protection,
before the aircraft gets established here, it must burn off some of that stuff. Some distance around each of the stuff. And you know, it couldn't burn it.
Oh, really?
It's just the stops are big enough that it's hard to get the fire started. And although it looks like a dense growth of thistles, and it was, yet each stalk is far enough apart that it was hard to get a flame to spread from one to the other. And we tried all sorts of dodges, and even put to the aircraft to see if it was able to put the engines on, cause the draft sufficiently great to carry a flame on. We tried enough. We decided maybe we were worrying unduly about this. So, well, here we were up to the getting towards the end of June. We declared ourselves ready for operations on the 25th of June, and on the following day, the 26th, 420, 425, we were sent out on our first. Well, that target on that occasion was the airfield of Siaka, down in the southern part of Sicily. And that was, and from then on, until the landing of Sicily, we were every night out, stocking up airfields and going marching yards and transportation facilities generally. That might be of value in the campaign and the 424th Squadron, the one on the satellite field, which became ready for operations on the 27th. And therefore it was only there from the campaign. And indeed, we declared it ready for operations in the morning of the 27th, and they were out early in operations that night, so they were just busy. And that, again, the target and on occasion was San Giovanni, and it was an airfield at San Giovanni, and I think my memory says it was on the southeastern corner of the place. We carried on, and as a matter of fact, operations out there were of a different tempo from the operations we've been accustomed to in the European theater. European theater, you've got to break at it quite frequently. I mean, the weather so often wasn't suitable for operations.
Right there, where we were, the weather was. It was suitable for operations, especially within 9 weeks. There's nothing to do with it here. and sustained operations like that are very hard to keep up. You know, it's hard to keep your aircraft service long enough to keep your supplies up, the fuel and the bombs. But we were on night after night. From that time we started there until the beat of the landing was Sicily. The only break we got was, and this was an unfortunate break, we ran into one of those conditions, weather conditions called a Sirocco. And you've probably heard of Sirocco. It's a miserable, absolute, stinkingly miserable condition where you get a wind blowing, strong wind blowing off the desert, right off the Sahara. And when it blows, it's as hot as the blast from a furnace door. And it's a build-up, generally, to bad weather. You get this high wind, hot air, and then it builds up, and you get a thundery condition, ultimately. And it lasts maybe 36 hours, and then 48 hours. The heavens open. It's the only rain you get. You may not get another rain for a month or so. But when it comes and rains, it rains. And we got one of those within a few days of the start of our operations, while people were still not really acclimatized. Here the air crew had been in been in the UK just a few weeks ago, and had a cold, miserable spring that we had there. And now they were out, and the Sirocco condition, the temperature generally ran 128 to 130 degrees.
Wow.
And it was absolutely debilitating, and it was actually the we talk about the windshield factor in Canadian winter temperature conditions. But this is the opposite condition. Well, it was the same condition at the other end of the scale,
mm-hmm.
where 128 degrees is devastating in itself. But if you get it with a 30 or 40 mile wind blowing, you can imagine how it takes away all of your normal body cooling arrangements. People are just absolutely washed out by it.
Yeah.
And
you have to get the hospitalized anything for this?
Well, I can't recall that. I think there were a few. Mm-hmm. I remember my, I think the biggest man I had out there, the heaviest, I should say, carrying a little bit more weight than he should have been carrying, was my senior intelligence officer, Paul Hano, Conley Hano. He was a big fellow, by any chance. We had to put him in the hospital. I suppose there were a few others, too.
Oh, boy, he must have been miserable.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to tell you a little bit about this Sirocco and the effect of it. The heat by day was awful, and of course, you carry on through the night. Normally out there in the desert, you get a cooling at night. Well, you would get some cooling at the night, but it would cool maybe down from 128 down to 115 or 112 or something like that. And so it didn't make for very good sleeping. But there came the period when the storm clouds built up and the thunder arrived, and the thunder and the rain, and the heavens opened. And those plains that had been so dry and parched and when I say parched, the ground was split with crevices all over the place. It was so dry.
Mm-hmm.
And here, all of a sudden, you have water galore and mud. It wasn't really sand there. As I mentioned 2,000 years earlier, it had been the great granaries of the Roman Empire, and that's where it had been irrigated, and therefore the sand had been broken down into soil, and now, in this day and age, it's just nice silt, sustaining nothing but thistles, because there's no longer any irrigation there. Irrigation went by many of the earlier wars. It was water, and that silt became gumbo. You can talk about the gumbo of southern Alberta, Pincher Creek and all those places. But the gumbo there, here, was without doing any gumbo in the world. And when it was wet, and you walked in it, you built up on the soles of your feet. Every step you took added an extra bit of weight. So you got to the point where you could, and there was a cohesiveness, an adhesiveness between your footwear and the ground. Got to the point where you couldn't quite miss the feet.
Mm.
And I always carried the thing to do was to avoid having to walk in it if you could. But if you had to, I always took one of my tent pegs and carried it in the belt of my shorts. And every so often you had to stop and use the tent peg. Feet to shovel that stuff off. Well, the rain came in the late evening of that second day of Sirocco. We had a problem regarding the aircraft because there were no airfield police. Personnel laid on for the purpose of safeguarding the aircraft against enemy action.
the idea, the thought was that when we got established, we would get local guards like the Spahis, the mounted horsemen and so on, who would do that for us. But we hadn't been there long enough to get this established. So it was necessary to put on each aircraft one of the ground crew, or one or more of the ground crew, I guess we had a couple in each aircraft, equipped with their Tommy guns to try to safeguard the machine. So the first night of when the rain came, the shooting started here and there. I could hear a burst of Tommy gun fire over in this direction, over in that direction. Well, it was one of the blackest nights I've ever seen, but I couldn't stand that. I had to get up and find out what was up. When I took one look out of that tent, and the sky was completely overcast, there wasn't a star in evidence, and there wasn't anything to give any light. And of course, there were really no established routes that pathways to follow, because you could get lost in the muck so easily, and you couldn't even see the next tent. It was so black. So I struck off, and I had a vague idea of where the service police tent was, and I decided I'd find out what was going on. Well, between the black of the night and the mud on the boots, I had some and the lack of visibility, I had some difficulty, but I managed by just sheer luck to stumble on the police tent. But before I did, I had to go down through a small wadi to get across this. And when I sensed the fact that I was going down to the wadi, I felt I was in the right direction. I was suddenly arrested. My attention was arrested by a little puff of light here and another one over there. Just the same sort of thing you would get from a cigarette being drawn on in the darkness. And they would sort of fade out and then come back in. It was the most eerie feeling. It was as though I had a sort of a sensation that there were people in the wadi. And I stood and watched this for a few moments. And then I saw something much bigger than a puppet that might have come from a cigarette. It was sort of the flame that you might get from a large candle.
Oh, yeah.
And it started to come down towards me, and then it would fade away. And as it came towards me, is that my telephone? Oh, I guess I just started ringing.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
Yeah. It's cut that.
Yeah.
There we are.
Well, the rain. Yeah. It was. It wasn't a downpour anymore, but it was raining. I challenged that light because it looked as though somebody was carrying it, and I had my revolver in my hand, ready for any eventuality. But the damn thing didn't answer the challenge, and it just faded away. Well, I carried on, and I got over to the police tent, and I was rather glad and happy to find the damn thing. I began to think I was going off a rocker, but I found that they had seen the same thing, and so. And they were completely confused by it. And of course, what had caused the shooting was that a number of these aircraft were dispersed not far from that wadi. And these boys, unaccustomed to guard duty in the first place, half terrified by the noises and the blackness of the night, were challenging these sort of flames and fires, and when they didn't, and sometimes they'd come right towards them, and they wouldn't get any response, so they'd shoot. Well, I wouldn't have believed it. I was awfully glad I got up that night, because I was annoyed at these chaps from for all of this shooting on what seemed to me unnecessary fire and shooting and panic and whatnot. And had I not got up and got out there into that wadi myself and seen it, I just couldn't have believed. But the only explanation that could be given was the fact that this water going down those crevasses in the ground, and particularly in the wadis, was getting down into an area where there was sulfur, phosphorus, and so on, and you're getting spontaneous, you're getting gases formed, which when they reached the surface, they came up out of the ground, reached the surface, were spontaneously igniting. That can happen with phosphorus, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as that gas was being flow was being sustained, that fire would be, flame would be evident. But as soon as it dissipated a bit in the atmosphere, it would disappear. And the damn thing would wander all around that wadi, and it just looked for all the world like either a group of Arabs in there or a group of stray Itais or Germans trying to get in a position to do some damage to the aircraft. So, fortunately, we didn't seem to have any damage when the aircraft were examined the next day from this gunfire.
Yeah.
I guess it was mainly outwards rather than inwards toward the camp. But we got away with it. But it was sort of a St. Elmo's fire effect. Although it wasn't really St. Elmo's fire. St. Elmo's fire, you do get on, it's sort of static electricity you get on aircraft at times.
Mm-hmm.
At night, it's visible at night. You get it by day and by night, but it's not visible at night. But this this was different again, because this was a chemical reaction rather than an electrical manifestation. But a very frightening one.
Gosh, did you find this Scirocco with all the sand being blown around damaging to the aircraft?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You get everything was sort of silted up, and it wasn't good. On another effect it had, of course, the runways and the roadways had a deep coat of this gumbo, and you just you were immobilized until that dried out. It didn't take long to dry out. Once the condition passed, the weather condition passed, and the sun was out again, and the dry atmosphere, very, very dry atmosphere out there, that thing would dry out at a rapid rate. Well, we weren't constrained to cease operations until it completely dried out. And when it was almost dry, we'd start to operate again. But when you started flying off these runways, you got a real compaction from the smooth wheel. There are smooth tires on those aircraft. And that compacting that mud down gave us almost a concrete-like surface.
Huh.
It was as hard as can be. I think there must have been something the nature of Portland cement in that still out there, because it was hard and almost shiny. And indeed, when you tried to dig in it, it was sort of the pick almost bounced out of the ground when you hit it.
Gosh, yeah.
I tried to get clever and submerge my tent. I needed a little extra headroom. My office was my living accommodation.